Is China's booming sports and wellness industry the next big opportunity for global brands? How do two multinationals tap into China's $35 billion outdoor market? How to resonate with Chinese consumers through localization and community strategies? And can the MNCs survive the rise of local sports giants? Welcome to ChinaBiz, the podcast where we uncover the opportunities and challenges facing multinationals in China. In this episode, we are deep diving into the booming sports and wellness industry, one of China's most dynamic and rapid growing sectors. Joining me today are two industry heavyweights: Tyler Price, GM of American high-end race bike brand Specialized, and Robin Trebe, former GM of Intersport and VP of Adidas in China. Both have played critical roles in shaping the success of these global brands in the Chinese market. And today they will share invaluable insights and lessons learned from the very front line of this exciting industry. I'm your host, Jacob Johansson, strategy and transformation consultant at PwC China. But just to be clear, the ChinaBiz podcast is my personal, independent project, and it doesn't reflect the views of my employer. With the disclaimer out of the way, let's jump in. Taylor and Robin, welcome to ChinaBiz.
Thank you.
Good to meet you. Thanks for inviting.
We are sitting here in the relatively new Specialized. It's your flagship store in Shanghai, is that correct?
It is, yeah. We opened it a year and a half, 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Quite an impressive setup compared to the classic bike shop in China, I must say.
Yeah, that was the idea, was to come in with something different into the market. And there's only one of them, but have it, just one flagship, but have it influence all over.
And it's a mark of the brand, of course, also. So thanks for having us here. I would like to start with you, actually. Because we know each other a little bit from way back, 20 years or something like this. I used to bike here. I remember when I met you the first time, we were cycling around in the morning at 4:30 or something like that, around Century Park in Pudong. And it was you and me and, on a good day, 15 other guys. That has changed.
Yes.
Today, the whole wellness industry, the sports industry, it's just booming in China. So my question to both of you, of course, TP, you have the cycling background, and Robin, you have a running, but also a sports blacktail. Try to put a few words on what is going on. I see race cyclists in Lycra and helmets everywhere. And right behind us is the running track along Huangpu River. It's packed with people. What has happened?
Yeah, like you said, long time ago, there was only a few of us riding around. And anybody that rode a road bike in Shanghai, you knew on a first name basis.
Yeah.
Regardless, Pudong, Guxi. And now there's so many groups that you can't even keep track of them all. And yeah, a lot has changed. I think a lot of the consumers here, people, they're just more health conscious. They're more active, more lifestyle conscious. They've been embracing things like cycling or running or yoga or hiking, all these other activities that just weren't on their radar before.
Right.
But with a growing middle class and social media influences, you know, of course, the pandemic created more health awareness as well. People want to be more active.
And you've seen the same Robin, in your previous position, VP in Adidas. You especially focused on running, right?
Personally, I'm a runner, but also I do triathlons. So, I come more from team sport. Intersport is a European company back in the days, and I worked for Adidas. But I see that also in the last 15 years, since 2010, I come regularly to China. I think one thing is from a macroeconomic perspective, I read that once a country the average GDP reaches $5,000 or above, people are starting to do sport because they have time and spendable money for that. So that is the overarching thing. I think $5,000 China surpassed, I don't know how many years, you maybe know that better than me. Then, of course, as Taylor said, COVID was a big influencer of that, where before career and money were values which are more important, but then that changed to health, family, well-being, and that definitely helped. People want to go outdoors, they have more time, more money, but they are more conscious of their health. So I think all those factors helped. And yeah, I think we don't see that only in biking or in running. I think across all sports, from niche sports like paddle, pickleball, there's like so many sports which are rising, which is great. And I see that for the next 10, 15 years that it's not changing, but it will grow here.
Yeah. But it is a huge change, because going back to when we were circling Sensory Park, I mean, sports was something Chinese consumers watched on TV, but it was not, you didn't participate, right?
Yeah, the focus was very much academics and career. And, you know, if you were out doing sport, then that was time taken away from the classroom. And, you know, now even there's government support to get kids, not out of the classroom, I'd say, but into other activities.
Yeah.
And not only be in the classroom all day.
With the China Healthy 2030, the government initiative, there are KPIs there. So per 1,000 people, there need to be 1.4 sport coaches. Per capita, there need to be 2.2 square meter sport facility. So there are certain KPIs which helps, which also helps us, of course, because we have more facilities available. And as you said, facilities like the running path along Huangpu River were not there 10 years ago, right? When we came here, so you could run 2 kilometers where the Nanjiang East Road came out, up and down. And now you can go 25 kilometers down and up, and also biking, you can do that. So that definitely helps.
Is this a lasting trend, or is that something, is this a bubble? But maybe it's too late to ask that question, because maybe time has already proven that this is here to stay. I don't know how you see it.
Yeah, it's from a lifestyle perspective, I think it's definitely here to stay. You know, commercially, brands are going to go up, they're going to go down, they're going to go through cycles. But I think as consumers and people embracing a more active, healthy lifestyle, I think that's here to stay. And you see that too. You know, we were mentioning the government support. This trail here on the Huangpu River is just one of many examples where there's been investment to create facilities.
Yes.
This whole area, I mean, next door is a golfing range, swimming pools, basketball, tennis courts, a whole sports complex. And with those things being built and set up, people have a place to go.
That running track right behind us is fascinating, because we are talking prime real estate. We're talking about 25 kilometers of waterfront real estate in Shanghai, a world city. And instead of selling it to the highest bidder and building skyscrapers and offices, you are turning it into a public space for exercise, sports, outdoor life. To take such a decision, it's quite bold. If we look at this boom, you know, from a commercial point of view, what has it meant for the sport and wellness business? When we talk about a boom, is that also reflected commercially?
Very much so. You know, I remember a number of years ago, a lot of the volumes in each individual store were relatively small stores. Some stores were struggling to survive in the last, I wouldn't just say COVID, because it started before COVID and the cycling space, but the last quite a few years have seen steady growth already.
Right.
You know, our brand has benefited from that, but the entire industry has been growing. And so, yeah, it has been a pretty good commercial success.
And I would say to look from outside, at least among the foreign bike brands here, you are, Specialized is quite dominating, wouldn't you say, you and Trek?
We're the two that I'd say are the most invested.
Yeah.
You know, we both have company entities set up here. We're not going through distributors or traders. And so we have a lot of skin in the game, so to speak. And so we've been investing quite a lot for a long time, both since the mid-2000s, to try to develop this market. And yeah, I think it's paid off.
Adidas celebrated last year 25 years anniversary. They were here since 1999. They opened office. There were products available before, but their own office, Adidas was 1999, and then Nike was 2-3 years earlier. They came with the first NBA broadcasting rights. Then, yeah, they were growing to, in the peak times, around 10,000 stores in China. 10,000. Now Adidas still has 8,500 stores around China. But then those were the golden days of the sport brands. Yeah, so they just opened every year. They opened 500 to 1,000 stores, 2-3 stores per day there. And then all the others, of course, came. Yeah, and in the last 10 years, Chinese brands really picked up. What is interesting, and then especially from an Intersport perspective, is there is not really multi-brand retail here, which is also then for the bike brands. Because on is 80-90% is own brands, and that a couple of other products in there. But from a development perspective, the mature market in the world, Australia and or USA or the North Americas, the Europe's, they all grew with multi-brand stores in all different sectors, like the big ones, the Intersports and Dick Sporting Goods, and then the special stores for biking, for outdoor, MD or whatever in USA. But in China, this didn't exist. So the brands came first. So that's why now we have this beautiful store where we are in now here, whereas in Europe, I'm not sure if you have something like that here, because typically you sell in specialist sports stores, right? Which from a consumer perspective also makes sense there, because then, for example, in running, you can have all the different brands in one store, the Adidas, the Nike, the Asics, so you can compare against each other. Whereas here, you'd first need to choose the brand, and then you choose basically what shoe you want
to
have.
Going to Robin's point about the mono-branded space. So when we came here in 2007, and again, we've been around since 1974, long time. We came and opened our first ever, globally, our first ever company-owned mono-branded store. We had never done that anywhere else in the world. And that store still exists today.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, in Shanghai and Jinzhou, in Pian. And that was the first one we ever did. And that then became the model that we decided to do throughout China.
Right.
In those days, nobody was riding a high-end road bike for racing or things like that.
Right.
But we stuck to it, and we continued with that mono brand,
right,
even under intense global pressure to move away from it.
Right. Wow. That's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, because the global model in the cycling industry is mono-branded retail. Multi-branded retail. And so there was a lot of pressure a number of years ago that we needed to expand the same way that we did in Europe, USA, Australia, etc. And we said no.
In my Intersport times, I was 7 years with Intersport here in China, and all the brands that I can name, some On Running, Hoka, Brooks, really big ones, they were struggling when they came here because there's no multi-brand. And typically, some brands are strong enough financially and also product-wise to open mono-brand stores. But there are, of course, also brands who are not big enough, who either don't have the reputation, the financial investment to open mono-brand stores. So how do you enter the market here? You can do it e-commerce only, but especially if you have a product which needs service, which needs after-sales service for setting the product, then how do you enter the market? Yeah, that is really the struggle of still until today. A lot of brands come here and say, but how should we enter the market here? Because there is no multi-brand. Intersport has now 55, 60 stores, but compared to then the 8,000 other stores, it's almost nothing. It's going somewhere, and especially the multi-brand category stores. There's a lot of football stores now that is developing. So it's going in that direction. But again, a lot of brands are really struggling with saying, we need to open our own stores, whether or not we want it.
The role of the store today is not just transactional, right? We purchase so many things from digital channels in China, and everything is deeply integrated. You know, Jack Ma introduced new retail this 15 years ago, and this is just the way we shop. So the physical space have a new role. It's almost like you go test and try and look at things. You might buy it on your phone on the way back in the Didi. Having control of a mono-brand environment have more purpose than the transactional in China, at least.
In the Raffles City shopping mall at People Square, there used to be a store 5-6 years ago, they opened and there was a robot preparing your cocktails and your coffee. That was a big trend. Yeah, also in that time with new retail and Alibaba starting all that. So people went there, bought a drink, took a video of that, put it on their social media, said, oh, wow, this is so amazing. A robot is preparing my drink. They went there one time and I think never come back. Okay, no conversion. Now, in that store is called Awa Handmade. So there's now 5 people doing handmade coffee in exactly that store now. So you see that, and I think that is exactly the trend. Physical spaces are more for handmade products, for customization, for bringing service there. And then the other world is the online world, yeah, where you just buy by convenience, you check everything is always available, you can get return it very easily, you can buy. But for certain products, you need the physical space to experience that, and people want that after COVID, after whatever, yeah, they want that physical interaction with people, that people give love to whatever their product is. They do the bike fitting, yeah, I'm sure they do that and spend 2-3 hours for the bike fitting, or more, maybe more. People want that because that you cannot get online. Yeah. And that is a trend which I see in China. If you have a good service, then you need that physical environment. That is great because we all live from physical interaction with people.
Here we have a very positive story. We have a wellness and sports boom. There are opportunities. My opinion is it's a very tough competitive environment here.
Yeah, like I said, we came in 2007. And if you look at the commercial side, the first many years were not that exciting.
You know, the exciting part came after your first 10 years of groundwork.
And then because of the groundwork that you laid and, you know, going back to this mono-branded thing, and the big part about that was that, especially as an international brand and a premium brand here in this market, you need to think what you can provide.
Mm.
And I've always told our colleagues from overseas that, you know, in Europe, US, we sell products. In China, we sell lifestyle and culture.
So we have to have that mono-branded space to do that. Otherwise, we're just transacting in product. If you can establish that type of culture and lifestyle for your brand here, that takes time. Then you can, maybe you could say, have more fun with it. But yeah, the beginning, I'd say the first 10 years, commercially, we're not super exciting.
But the situation is also tough now in the sense that if just take a look at the competitive landscape, right? You see domestic bike brands, but in running shoes, whoa, there's a lot to choose from, right? It's not like you have the international premium brand here. It's just so much better than anything domestic. You get a run for your money now, right?
So absolutely. I mean, when again came to the market in 2010, we looked at those brands and basically it was relatively copies of our shoes in a not really good quality. So it was a very different consumer who bought this one or this one. But now those brands absolutely picked up. They got good people in, they got technologies in, and they offer, especially on the entry to mid price, they offer very competitive, good products for sure. But I mean, the point is, if you have an interesting field in sport, whatever you are in, running or cycling or outdoor, if there's a big market, then there will be more players. And especially in China, with all the entrepreneurship here, there are so many interesting brands who develop a certain niche product. The market is big enough now that even with a very niche product, you only have camping, cooking stuff or something like that. It's big enough, the market, right? So that is an interesting one. Most other markets in the world are not big enough that a local brand can sustain. But here, there's a lot of local brands in all the different sectors here who can only live from the domestic market. Interesting will be then the next step. Are they good enough? Are they willing to step outside of China? Yeah, that will be very interesting for me to see in the next 10, 15 years.
Right, yeah, right. You mentioned the price point. I'm interested in how you see this now, because how do you balance premium positions? I did some of your bikes cost 100,000 RMB. I cannot do the conversion to US dollar here. The listener can do it themselves, but that's a pretty hefty investment in a road bike. And the same with running equipment and sports garments and other things that How do you balance, how do you find the right mix between the premium position and high price? And that's obvious drive towards more affordability we see in the market right now.
You have to consider, right? Because, you know, some of those products are growing the market, you know? Like you mentioned, we have bikes that would be, let's say, $15,000. That's an expensive product. And not everybody's going to buy that. And you can buy some road bikes in China for $600 or $700. But you can look at it from two ways. In one way, that's great because now it's accessible to many more people. And if you have a million people that have access to it now, where only a few did before, some of them are going to upgrade in the future because there's more awareness.
Right.
You know, 10 years ago, I told people I worked for Specialized and they had no idea what I was talking about. And it actually, I'm still getting used to it. People now, they know whether they have it or not. Maybe they have these other brands. But if they didn't have those brands, they would never know your brand.
Yeah.
And if you are offering a complete package of services and everything that they would like to have, then they can upgrade into your brand. So there's a place, like you said, I mean, the market is big. So there's a place for all these other players. But you really have to be sharp on your game about what you can offer.
And don't dilute too much from your core positioning. Yeah. So
yeah,
of course, Specialized could probably say we offer a cheap bike for again, $500-$600, but would that damage the brand there? I see in China, there's two things. So entry price works and premium still works. There's still enough people who really have that money to buy that expensive, whatever other stuff there. But the middle price point is always difficult in China. In various industries, cheap, which is mostly an online thing, but also offline there, or premium works. I see that in different industries. And I think that is something, there is still a market for both. And you need to just decide, do I want to be in this one or this one? But there's very few brands who can really manage to be in the complete premium segment and in the price entry there. But if you have that specific USB for whatever entry or premium, I think there's still a way to go. And as Taylor said, so I think brands like Decathlon are great, or like local brands, because you don't start, if you start road biking, you don't want to directly invest 100,000 RMB. But you want to try it, you do it for 1 or 2 years, and then you can resell it for 50% of the price. There's a lot of secondhand bike WeChat groups and whatever. You can always sell that stuff. But yeah, that's both prices still work if you have that positioning.
As like you said, the market is big. If you look at auto space, I don't think Ferrari or Maserati volume has gone down because of the growth of BYD. I'd say
the opposite. Or whatever, they use it.
Yeah,
it's premium.
In certain spaces, and the positioning that you create is not negatively impacted by the growth of others.
And there's another interesting thing about premium products in general. You see investments or private consumption move away from, to some extent, from classic luxury, from that token luxury show-off stuff to something which is more lifestyle-oriented. It could also be travel and other more explorational ways of spending your hard-earned money, right? That the new luxury is in experiences or activities more than a handbag.
Yeah, because you're competing in the premium space. You're not just competing for people's dollar. You're competing for time and attention.
Yeah.
You know, are they going to spend the money on this product, or are they going to go on vacation?
Yeah.
Or are they going to, you know, do something else? And so it's, you know, what are you offering to them that's going to enhance their life, their lifestyle, that you're competing against for their time and money?
Right. From a marketing point of view, as a brand, it makes sense not just to talk about yourself, but also actually invest in growing the category.
We always track how many running races there are per year. Yeah, and it went up to 10,000 registered road races last year, up from 500 in 2010 or something like that. That's times 20. Yeah. So, and if you just, as you say, if you keep even your market share only flat, you grew by times 20 because there's 20 times more people who need a race shoe, correct? I'm still so confident on China because just the market is still not mature and not full.
So you say the market's still not mature because you see in other categories, that there was a rush in for multinationals because it was blue ocean. There was no competition. They all invested, they set up. And now we see a bit of the opposite, that there's maybe an overcapacity. So some are fading away or deciding to leave or at least rethinking the strategies. That's sort of the work I do these days. So when you look at the wellness and sports industry, do you still see a lot of opportunity? Do you still see this market as open for business, unsaturated, full of opportunities, or has it settled?
I think it's still open for business, but I think you need to be very aware. As a multinational brand coming in, you need to be very aware of what you're getting into, and you need to do your homework. And you need to be willing to spend a lot of time understanding. You know, that's one of the biggest parts of my role in the company is not translating words, is translating understanding between, I mean, we're a U.S. company, a California company, and having them to understand what we need to do and why we need to do is one of the biggest parts of my job, one of the biggest challenges, and kind of allowing China to run China. Because the thing that made you successful in your home market might not be the thing that makes you successful in this market. Right. And the greater understanding and respect you have for this market, the greater your chances.
I meet a lot of CEOs in my professional job, and they all talk about the same topics. They say, we have problem to explain the reality on ground, and we are not allowed our quota now to let China run China. We are there's and at home, they look at statistics, there's so many people, so much consumption. It's all number-driven, not insights-driven. How do you get approval to let China run China?
Is not always easy, but a few moments that stand out. You know, I was on a bike ride with our founder, and one time in California, having a difficult discussion, and I just said, "Look, you hired me to be the China expert, so let me be it, and get out." And he said, "Okay," and let us do it.
Yeah.
And our current leadership team, to their credit, they listen. You know, we have a company principle of seek to understand, and they do. And where we don't agree, we work it out. The biggest thing is that, you know, helping them understand that what we do here is very, very true to the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And we show them that, and they see that.
You're not diluting your position or your global story or
the opposite. So I could read you an email that I got from our CEO 2 days ago, because I sent a report of a bunch of the images of, we opened a bunch of stores last year. And I sent it over to him, and he replied back and copied all the global leadership. And he just said, thanks for giving us an insight into our future, because the mono-branded space that they pushed on me to go away from years ago is now where they want to go.
Wow.
So instead of China being the place where, you need to adopt the overseas strategies, we're now exporting the China strategies overseas. And so that's very interesting, because both the CEO and the chairman both replied and just said, yep, that's our future.
Do you see, Robin, anything like this in your category, that China become an example for the rest of the world?
Absolutely. It's just like, I mean, there are the two complete extremes. Yeah, the back in the days, it was like you apply your global strategy, bring it to China and hope that it works. Yeah. And then there's a lot of companies now, and I really love what you said just before, is that they completely localize. Yeah, they completely localize their product, their way of working, they localize the values, which is also not right, because then you lose some of your benefits, your values there. Yeah. So you need to stand for something. So there's these two complete extremes, applying completely the global strategy, completely localizing here. Both is not correct. There is something in between.
Yeah.
So you need to understand Chinese consumers. Why do they buy certain products? Maybe they want to have a different marketing approach. They want to have a slightly different, from easy things, the colorways or whatever formula in the product there. But there are brands, and I think, I mean, the last question was, is there still a space for new brands, right? So, and I can absolutely say yes to that. I mean, there is still a lot of brands who come new, who came in the last 2 or 3 years even, where sometimes, yes, I agree, it takes time, sometimes not. I mean, they were right away successful because either there was already interest I mean, you can always track that with social media. Is there already user-generated content on a certain brand or even gray imports or fakes in here, which is a good sign actually for new brands. Yeah, because people, brands approach me and say, okay, oh, we have already fake products in the market. Say, oh, congratulations, yeah, that. Because otherwise there's no demand for your brand. So, and then say, okay, how can I use that here now? So, because you are hot, but one, what is your distribution strategy then? What is your product portfolio? But absolutely, there's a space for brands to come, but it's maybe not as easy as 20 years ago. But if you have the right strategy, 100%.
A lot of people think they can come without a strategy. That is just enough to open a shop at the high street and the customers way. It's not enough to say made in EU or USA. You must have a stronger narrative and reason for being, right? You must have a strategy. Yeah, and as crazy as it may sound, I see the companies, foreign companies entering China without a, what I would call a solid strategy.
Even that can work if you have an easy to sell product, you do an online only approach. Okay, I have an easy to sell commodity product, I can sell it. But that in 99% of the cases, that doesn't work. So you need, of course, to know market insights, consumer insight, your strategy, and then you start your business. And probably it takes a while. I always liked that example of Aldi, for example. Yeah, Aldi, the German food retailer, and they were here for 5 years without selling anything. They did market research here. They built up their supply chain. And now if you compare how Aldi is doing business in Europe, North America versus here, it's a very different thing. Yeah, but they applied local products. They applied the same logic that you get your product delivered within 30 minutes to your home, which in Aldi, in Germany, you cannot home delivery at all. So you need to do that. Yeah, and there are brands who did that very successfully. And there are brands who just, as you say, without strategy come in and say, okay, let's see.
Do you need to have a Chinese tailored running shoes or sports equipment? I know in home furnishing, for instance, if you don't have a local range, you will struggle because life at home is so different from, let's say, in a Western Boston. Mm.
Yeah, for a long time, we have had the same product line globally. I mean, you can't really reinvent the bike to have, it's still two wheels and a frame, right? But you can do some things to connect with local consumers. The last couple of years, we have done different colors and everything specifically for Chinese New Year. Last year was the year of the dragon, and we did do a dragon bike, but there was no red, yellow, or gold on the bike. And actually, a lot of the people that saw the bike were really surprised that this came from a Western brand. But the local team here created such a deep and amazing design brief that the designers in California were able to create something mind-blowing. And the same for this year. And so those designs and those things, they shows that the brand really has a lot of respect for the market and not just trying to, okay, here's a golden red dragon. No, this is like, you see those examples, right? We didn't even make very many of them. So selling it or not wasn't a big commercial changer. What it was basically just showing understanding and respect of the culture,
right,
and the market. And we sold a few of them.
You've done an effort, right, with that design briefing where you see a lot of brands just, as I said, just, adding a golden dragon and think that would be enough, but it's almost like arrogant to some extent.
Exactly. And that was exactly what we wanted to avoid. Instead, and so even myself, I did not participate in the briefing. I'm not from here. I've been here a long time.
Yep.
I don't have the same understanding that our teammates here have. And so, yeah, the result was fantastic.
And I think there's, again, no black or white. The product range, there are certain categories, let's say in the whole sport categories, there are categories where you don't need to adapt at all. I mean, a football shoe is a football shoe. Yeah. So even the Chinese consumers want a football shoe, which Messi or Cristiano Ronaldo or whatever is wearing. Yeah. There's not a lot of adaptation to that. Yeah, and of course, you can do certain Chinese New Year ranges or whatever cooperation with something. Yeah. But Then there are other categories where, of course, you need to adapt. But as you say, it's not enough to just put a dumpling and a dragon on a T-shirt and then say, this is our China way. You still see that. But then there are brands which do it much better. Vego, for example, is always doing an amazing CNY collection, which really is, I would say, not this dump, just putting some symbols on it, red and gold, but they really think about it for a long time, I think, there. But also other than CNY, of course, when you are in apparel, you need to adapt the fitting. Of course, there's no doubt. I mean, of course, there's the different measurements of Chinese consumers versus the Western world. Of course, you need to do that. If you don't do that, you are out of the market, basically. So you need to do that. And then certain other categories, you need to adapt 80% of your products and certain others only 20%. So, but you really need to see, how can I create my China range with not forgetting our global value? Because otherwise, you are just using the shell of the brand and doing something completely different here. That doesn't make sense.
That balance is very interesting. You know, there's no reason for an international brand to try to be more Chinese than the Chinese. You know, you're not going to win that competition, right?
No, you're never going to win that one. You are an international brand, and you need to lean into your heritage. Yeah. That's what makes you special. It's a matter of communicating that and those values, because values can translate. Mm. You know, respect, love, admiration, those sorts of things, those can be universal. And that's where you need to...
Well, where do you get your insights? One thing is to read statistics. So there's so many people are buying bikes and so many people are buying running shoes or apparel, but that's not insights. That's math or statistics, right? How do you get the sense of what's really going on behind the facade?
For me, just a lot of listening. I try to be as quiet as possible in most meetings. Hmm. And just learn, because a lot of my teammates know more than I do.
Uh-huh.
When I'm with dealers, a lot of times I'm just listening. When I go on rides, anytime I travel, I pretty much ride with local groups or local riders and things, and I just listen. I don't have to have all the answers. I just hear the feedback a lot and then discuss with the team and figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah.
But that's just one area where you still get the stats and any sort of industry reports you can get and all these things you still try to get. But a lot of it is, I mean, the bike industry is still a one-on-one thing. One person comes into a store and then it's a one-on-one relationship to get a bike. And so you're never going to get away from a one-on-one relationship. And so listening to that person and doing what you can with the information.
I guess you need, listening to consumers and participating, of course, helps. Yeah, but we cannot get all the insights. So we need a strong team, of course, working with us on those. And then also a lot of times you need professional agencies or whatever doing surveys for you. Yeah, so there's still the demand for in-depth qualitative or quantitative consumer researches, because you might have a very different perception. Your global CEO is coming here, you do a bike ride here in Shanghai, you see there's 250 people showing up for your bike ride in the morning, but that is not the reality of whole China. But if you go then to Hangzhou, Suzhou, or even tier 3, 4, 5 cities, what is the reality of, let's say, bike rides there? It's a very different thing. So you need to have the team in place who gives you the insights, the consumers' insights, your dealers, if you have dealers, but also still there's a very high demand for professional, in-depth market and consumer research here. That is definitely, especially for us, our wise here, we need that, because we will never understand 100% the Chinese. We need a strong team. Yes, we can also go on Xiaohongshu, so Red, we can read, we can see what's going on, what are the hottest topics there, but the whole day following all that, we'll never have all the insights. So a strong team supporting you on that is very important.
You see in the sports category that this is maybe one of the strongest categories in terms of building communities. Of course, it's because sports and running is also passion, right? People are willing to connect with other people. There's a social component. You bike or run with other people. But let's go back to talk about how you do communities. Is that a source for taking the temperature? Are these communities, those WeChat groups, those group rides, those social activities you do as a sports brand, although can you leverage that for insights?
For sure. And you should. If you're doing community events and people are saying things about your brand or your products, those are people who care.
Mm.
And so you should listen, for sure.
And then those who don't like you actually may carry the most important message.
I mean, everybody's talking about community. Are there a lot of brands who are having really a good community strategy other than opening a WeChat group and saying, okay, I do a morning run or a bike ride? Because that is not the same. I mean, if you have a group with 250 people in Shanghai and then occasionally you do some things there, that is not really a community. A community is something by definition that you regularly do, that people, the same people come together there. And then of course the risk is also with that the community is not open anymore, but always every time the same 25 people show up. You have maybe 200 people in your WeChat group, but always the same 25 people show up. That will also long time not help you. Of course, that is good, but that is not a community strategy. Yeah, so in China alone, on one of the biggest running apps here, Joyrun, there are 20,000 registered running communities. How would you, I mean, that is a
12,000 communities.
Communities. What? Communities. Let's say I sign up there and say, okay, I have the FitFam Shanghai. I'm one of the organizers of that. We do runs, we do yoga, we do free workouts for everybody. So, but what I wanted to say is I can register FitFam then on Joyrun, say, okay, there's a FitFam run coming up. 20,000 running leaders are there. 20,000. Yeah, imagine what treasure that is to reach all these people. And below these 20,000 communities, and there are between, let's say, 5 to 500 people in there. So if you would really reach those people and you can create somehow, which is then the biggest issue, somehow a loyalty. Everybody can say, okay, all these 20,000 people get a free pair of shoes or socks, which is an expensive thing, but you can do that. But do you really create loyalty with that? It's a different thing. But it's just a treasure. And all these WeChat groups, the communities here in China, if you know how to use them, but the point is not only like once at a time engage with them, but really constantly engage with them, it creates that loyalty. Yeah. That is the secret.
It's also complicating things. I remember the early days of cycling. We had one WeChat group, and if you posted there, you reached everybody. Now everybody have their own little community with their friends, right? And you see this filtering through it. So also on top corporate level in automotive industry, NIO is still have a big community for everybody, but they had diversified their community strategy, talking about tribes instead, where they have a lot of small communities for people who also know each other offline. So there's a tendency to these communities changing. Instead of being one brand, all followers in one community, to be more smaller, niche. I only want to buy at Century Park, so that's my group. I only want to buy in Qiantan, so that's
how do you as a brand control that then? That is a secret, right? So I don't know how you, for example, do that, but that is the thing. So the more fragmented it gets, then you have, of course, you have your corporate WeChat account and all these groups are below, but then there's a second group outside of that because they want to not communicate with all the 200 people, but they have their 10 people. But how do you control?
But one way is to look at communities in a new way. Instead of say, community is mine, I own it, I decide everything, I facilitate it, it's a broadcasting channel. I think that one of the keys is for brands to think, I'm not necessarily owning this community, but I'm participating in it. So I can be in all those 20,000 running groups, but I don't have to steer a corporate message and everything. I'm just another contributor.
A lot of this stuff, it should be organic. You know, I've had a lot of dealers that would say, oh, my riders, my this. And I said, they're not yours. they chose to transact with you, or they chose to join some of your things, but they're not yours. They're part of a bigger community of cycling enthusiasts, which in my opinion shouldn't really be branded. The community, the brand should exist and they should help support communities, but the community shouldn't be branded.
No.
The community should be organic, authentic, people that like to do it. And I mean, like you said, it used to be one cycling group and now there's so many cycling groups. But those are the people that you choose to ride with, that you want to be with. And there's times when brands can do events where people come from a whole bunch of micro communities together to watch a Tour de France or a Paris-Roubaix, whatever it is. And brands can facilitate that type of stuff.
Right.
But yeah, I'm not a fan of brands saying, oh,
I own this community.
So I think there are certain brands who should have their own communities, or we call it in Adidas connected communities. Yeah. So we had, let's say, Shanghai Half Marathonists happening in April. And then we invite 50 of the biggest running communities to come together. We do a race together. And then certain people per community, let's say the fastest two or whatever, can join on behalf of Adidas, can join that. Yeah, that is an activity, and that they come together, but it's a connected community, we call that. Yeah. Owning your own community, it works. I think in some areas it works, but I agree the community is only organically growing if there's someone with passion without any monetary interest behind there. Because a lot of cases, even brands pay people to run the community. It works for a certain time, but then that person disappears, or that person believes, I'm strong enough now to do my own community outside of that world, taking all the people outside, and then you lose everything from that. Yeah. So that's why it's a very interesting one, how to do that. I agree completely with you that this connected community, inviting them for certain events there, is a better way. The problem with that is, how do you really create loyalty?
It does challenge the mindset of some global brands, at least, because they are, at least here in China, more used to owning and running and controlling things. Where what I hear from both of you is actually a little more that the brand is a follower. We go into this community, we participate, but we are not necessarily taking the lead on everything. That can be run by anybody. So it's a little more being a follower instead of enforcing a strategy or forcing users to do certain things?
I don't know if I'd say follower, I'd say a facilitator.
Mm.
You can facilitate community. You can give different communities purpose and support. From a specialized perspective, we can do events that people from a whole bunch of different communities can come to. And it should be open to that.
Right.
You know, and people can come on whatever bike they want, and they should. You know, we don't only service or cater to a specialized owner. Really, we cater to cyclists.
Yeah. And even better if they don't come with a specialized bike, because that is a potential sale for the next time, right? Yeah. So, and I had a couple of brands where I said, okay, but if you show up, you need to wear our product there. I say, that doesn't make any sense there, because then you only reach the same people again, which you anyway have here as your customers. It doesn't make any sense really there. So yeah, this community topic, we could have a separate topic. I think it's a very interesting one. It's super important, but very few brands really do it right.
I argue in my book, From Customer to User, that if you are customer-centric, you are preaching to the choir. They already accepted you. They already bought your goods.
Yeah.
You have to expand your view to now get a wider audience and include some of them who are not won over yet.
Of course, you should keep them. But there's this very good example in your book. I read your book. So with the kitchen, because there's only a very short time that you want to attract someone with your kitchen. And then 15 years, you don't have that as a customer, because you don't even want him to come back, because the only reason why he's coming back is because of a complaint. That is different in bike, because you can always upsell and new tires and this and this and this. But in certain areas, you don't even want that, right? So that's a very interesting one.
There were one person reading my book. That was me.
Thank you.
If you're a CFO out there, I can see them and now bubbling with one question. That is, how do you do conversion from this? One thing is that you invest in doing rights and social things and a community, what have you. But at the end of the day, you want to see conversion in the store online. Is there a tool for that?
This is a little bit of chicken and egg thing, right? And, you know, is there a specific ROI? And in other categories, maybe. You know, in the running space or something, maybe there is. In the cycling space, there's not one that I've seen yet. And so, not to sound like trivial, but how you measure that, are people wanting to be with you? Are people smiling? Are people happy? Do people want to be around? If you throw a party, does anybody come? You know, you measure it that way. And of course, you're looking at your total business. Is your total business growing? You're investing in these things. Is more and more of it happening? Yeah, you're looking at those things. But it's like, okay, I do X event, X amount of people show up, and I get X sort of return.
But it's tougher to, speaking return of investment, it's harder to say, I did that left turn and that happened, right? So it's more the sum of your initiatives that brings you somewhere.
And the consistency over time. To do one event one time and think that you're doing community. Doesn't work.
No. But if the people engaged with you 150 times, the chance is very high that they then also convert, right? So if they see you on social media, if they join your events, if they interact with you, come to the store, maybe even have a coffee here, there, for sure at one point they will buy something. Is it a t-shirt? Is it a bike? Whatever they can afford, but the chances are getting higher. And of course, an ROI-wise, I had a lot of times this discussion, how much do we spend? How much do we get out? We have 200,000 members, community members per person. If the average spend is 250 euro per person versus normal people spend 120 euro or so. So then the difference is 200,000 times, I don't know, whatever I said, 120. So that costs us 20 million. So how much did we get back? You can't do that. But at the end, it's also about social engagement. It's about social media engagement. Yeah, how much conversion, how much traffic, how much UGC you get. So there is not really one way of doing it. But of course, a CEO always like how much more sales we generate from that. Long term, you will, but not short term.
Let me ask both of you. Do you have a very strong gut feeling as leaders that if I do X, Y, Z, this is going to happen?
I would say in the short term, no.
Mm.
In the long term, yes. You know, like we have people in our retail stores that their role is doing community and events. That role doesn't exist in our stores overseas.
Mm.
Yeah, because they don't do it.
May I ask you, so these people doing this, they are in the store, not in an office, but in the store. That's frontline. That's me. That the people who do these things are confronted.
Like that. It needs to be like that, because then they join the bike ride. And then people come here, hang out, say, oh, okay, when do we go again? Thursday morning. By the way, I also need a new bike, or best case. That is how it has to be. And I try to implement that at Adidas, which I can say now it was a bit painful. I wanted to have in each of our flagship store at least one person who is salesperson, but Nick gets freed up for like 6-7 hours per week to do 2 times or 3 times a run. And then people can engage with that person. That is ideal. That's a dream job also for the
ambassador. Yeah.
That's ambassador. So they get paid, they work in the store for whatever the other 30, 35 hours, and then they have some spare time to fulfill their dreams, to do their hobby. That's amazing. And also that keeps the staff retention much higher, because they feel, wow, I can do that there. Yeah. There's always, of course, the risk that they still, again, if they have that certain followership, and then they say, okay, now I do my own bike shop or running shop. Of course, that always happens. Yeah, that can happen. But still, if they are getting well treated and if they have time to do their hobby as an ambassador, as Taylor said, for sure, they will stay longer, and in the end, they will also sell.
All right. If you look at the facility we're in right now, downstairs, there's, I don't know if you saw, there's a big room, a big area with showers. Several times a week, the staff here will lead rides, sometimes in the mornings to catch that group, and then sometimes at lunch, they'll catch that group. They come back, they have the showers here, they can go back to their regular job. We also have this space here, this office. I'll work out of here one day a week just to be in the store and observe. Last night I was helping teach someone how to change a tire. You're seeing firsthand on the front lines a lot of this stuff. And the staff are going out riding with people. And we have built the facilities to enable that so that we can be actively engaged in the community.
It goes through a lot of what you were saying today, this thing about being hands-on with things in China. You can't sit in an ivory tower somewhere and look at it, or look at it from outside. You have to chase that tire. You have to be on front line and actually be part of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the universal advices you give to multinationals in China, then be a little more hands-on than in another market?
It goes back to what I would have said earlier, that you have to take time to understand, because the market is different here than maybe what you've experienced, Europe, US, or something like that. It's just a different place. They consume differently, and there's different expectations. We offer different services here in our shop that we don't offer in our US stores.
Right.
And so, yeah, observing, understanding, and adapting.
Frontline, you can say, it's not only a China thing. I mean, you have a lot of people who are in the business, but who don't know the business. Yeah, I mean, I don't say that you necessarily need to work on a shop floor when you work for a retail company, but Does it help to be one day on a designated day on the shop floor? Because the company said one day per year, every of our executives needs to be on the shop floor. Everybody has that, yeah? But that's so bullshit, because then you just stand next to it. You have this artificial environment where everything is super clean, where all the store stuff is there. You maybe hear some consumer insight, but you're not really in it. So this once per week working here will give you much more insights then, yeah? But this artificial going on the shop floor, that doesn't work. Yeah, that's just like I've seen in so many companies I work for, one day per year or in half day, you learn absolutely nothing.
But then, Robin, let me ask you a question, because compared to Specialized, the whole Adidas setup is much more corporate, from what I hear now. And do you think when you look at that system, you don't have to comment on Adidas as such, but if you look at that type of company, do you think it's fair to say that some MNCs are they good enough to do that frontline? You say, yeah, it's a given. Of course, we have to do it, but are they doing that?
Should they do it 100%? Do they have the ability of doing it 100%? And then you should go on a Saturday when it's busy into Nanjing East Road store. You should be there and really physically sell products and not stand next to it, but really be on. Of course you can do that. It's not a question if you have a $50 billion business or $5 billion. If you really want to understand your consumers, I think it's a given thing that you engage with your people.
We're almost at the end now. I would just like to summarize and ask, I'm sitting here with two capacities, with a lot of successes and maybe also some failures under the belt. That's great. That's where we learn. If you should try to, maybe this is a tough question, but summarize one or two, three lessons that would be relevant for an MNC leader listening to our conversation right now, what would you throw at them as, you know, this is what you need to do, or this is what you need to be aware of if you want to expand or even enter China right now?
And not to be the dead horse, I've said it a few times, but you need to be willing to understand and do your homework and adapt and then go full gas.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously there's no one playbook for success, yeah? But in the end, you have to do the same things, just with a different weight and a different execution, what you do in the rest of the world. So it's all about, do I have the right products for the right consumers? You really need to learn it. And as we heard, Taylor said, he is here since 20 years. He learned it from ground for 17 years. There is no shortcut for success.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. If you want to dive deeper into our topic, I'll link to my latest article about the subject below. And don't forget to hit subscribe to stay up to date with all things ChinaBiz. And of course, feel free to recommend the podcast in your network to help us grow an audience. Comments or suggestions? I'd love to hear from you. The best way to reach me is through WeChat. Details are below as well. Thanks for tuning in, and catch you next time.